Good morning, Dong Ping. How are you doing?
Yeah, good morning, Jeff.
How's the beautiful Asheville?
Beautiful, beautiful. Asheville is very beautiful. But my students are very, very worried
Why?
about the future
Oh, well.
because we had a new president. We have a new president now.
Yeah, but he is better than Hillary Clinton.
I believe so. That's
I
why I wish for him.
yeah, I voted for him too, and I'm a communist. It's Hillary that created the big pivot to Asia to encircle China. She's a warmonger.
Yes.
She's the one that just led the destruction of Libya and the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. She was for the invasion in Iraq. She was for the invasion in Afghanistan. She was all during the time she was, Secretary of State. She was supporting the destruction of Syria. The Saudi Arabians have given her tens of millions of dollars, and they are the U.S. proxy army in Yemen. She is an indictable war criminal and an indictable criminal for crimes against humanity.
I agree.
So given the choice, and Trump said he's ready to sit down with Xi and cut a deal. He's ready to
That's his
talk.
thing.
That's all you can ask is let's talk, let's talk.
Yes. Yep.
So anyway. All right. Well, are we ready? I hope we have a better connection today. But I was actually able to piece together a nice 25-minute introduction and explanation about
Yep.
the Great Leap Forward. And so now I'm ready. We can wrap up the Great Leap Forward and move
Yep.
on to the Cultural Revolution.
Yep.
Are you ready, sir? Do you have your hot? Do you have some nice Chinese tea?
Yes, I do.
I do too. All right, here we go. Okay, well, so what you're telling me then, Dong Ping, is let's just review what you have told us about the Great Leap Forward. You not only told us about it, but you wrote a book about it, part of which your book, the Unknown Cultural Revolution. You explain your life. And to sum it up, what you said is that and for thousands of years, whenever the Chinese masses had a famine, that they would always rise up against the government in power, even though they were starving, and they would do it with their overwhelming numbers, with bamboo spears, even if they were starving and hungry. And during the culture, during the Great Leap Forward, because of the after effects of the Korean War, because the Americans and the Taiwanese were sending in hundreds of suicide missions into China to try to overthrow the government, the peasants were actually armed with machine guns, pistols, rifles, etc. But even though they were armed, very well armed, they did not rise up against the government during the Great Leap Forward. It
They have
was,
no reason to do it.
yeah, exa and they had the means to do it more than any other time in history. It was we didn't really get into the numbers, but your article, which I will post, demonstrates that it was one of the Great Leap Forward was one of the greatest industrial expansions in history, outstripping even the United States, Japan, Germany, during their
Even Russia. So what do you mean?
and the Russians, yeah, during their rapid industrial expansions. That you couldn't do all that if you were starving to death. They built many thousands of dams, reservoirs, and irrigation systems.
80,000.
Yeah,
80,000
80,000. 80,000, and you couldn't do that if you were starving to death. And then to cap it all off, the most famous Western book about the Great Leap Forward, Frank Dicotter's Mao's Great Famine, so-called Great Famine, I guess we could say, was blatantly dishonest, using a Life magazine photo of a starving Chinese from a 1946 famine before liberation in 1949, because he could not find one from the Great Leap Forward in 1958 to 1961. And then he also was dishonest in that he, or either that, or as you said earlier, although it got a little bit garbled in the recording, that he's a so-called Chinese expert. Either he was dishonest or can't read Chinese, because he misinterpreted a speech by Mao where he said he would be satisfied to cut the number of industrial projects from 1,000, this was in 1960, from 1,000 to 500, if it meant completing 500, and Dicotter interpreted that as Mao saying that he would be happy to slaughter to kill half the people in China. You know, so anyway,
the other half could have money enough to eat.
Yeah, so that the others would have enough to eat. So here we. Now, as a scientist and as a rational person, you were there and on the ground. And also, you mentioned that the food was being transported all over the country, you know, from thousands of kilometers away. The government had set up, you know, tremendous logistics to try to move food from more abundant areas to areas that were having you know, natural disasters and droughts and floods and everything, and that in your opinion that if they hadn't done that, that people would have starved, but it actually kept people from starving.
Yes,
and
there is another issue actually most people didn't know, and it's 1960 and 61 is the 100 year unprecedented natural disaster. Okay, most people didn't see talking about that.
Yeah,
many people only talk about how people were being hungry. Yes, we were hungry, but we were not starved.
Yeah, exactly.
Why? Because we have a public dining hall, and if you don't have any food to eat, you will die in 7 days.
Yeah.
The public dining hall was there all the time. The meal they provided was not lot, but you have one bite, you have one bowl of porridge every meal. That is very, very sleek supply, keep people alive.
Yeah, exactly.
That's very essential. Without without a public dining hall, more people would have starved.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, in any society, whenever natural disaster strike, what happens? The capitalist profiteer from food. The price of grain went up, right?
Yeah.
And people storing for grain to make a profit. But that never happened in socialist China.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important. You don't see many fat people. Everybody were equally starved. Right? Because of that, we survived as a nation.
Yeah.
We didn't have, you see, like in the old days, people eat people, right? We never, you know, that's what is unbelievable about socialism. We shared the little food we had and prevented a major starvation.
Mm-hmm. And so what you were saying is that, and you also talked to people in Henan, Anhui, and...
Yeah.
Other provinces that were further away from Shandong, all big agricultural producing areas, and
yeah, I'm talking about it's not just personal experience.
Yeah.
I'm talking about on the basis of research in countryside where the famine is supposed to be very bad.
And from what you're telling, and from what you experienced, and what these other people experienced, is people were hungry. sometimes very hungry, but nobody or very, very, very few people starved to death in spite of the Western books and magazine articles and videos and everything claiming that, tens of millions of people died. Everything you're telling me says that that's not true.
It's not true.
Okay.
I was invited to give a speech in Hunter College in 1993. And my talk was the accomplishment of the Great Forward. And I remembered that day the auditorium was packed. But before I would start, there's a guy sitting in the front row, old man. And he told me he was the chairman, president of U.S.-China Friendship Association. And his name is Hugh Dean. And he asked me if I was the speaker of that day. I said, yes. He said, face it. He yelled at me. Face it, young man. 13 million people starved to death. And you had the guts to come here to tell us the great forward accomplishment? No, I was very young at the time. I was very inexperienced. But somebody yelled at you before your speech is very, very upsetting.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I didn't let him upset me. I said to him very calmly, I said, let's face together. How did you get your number? That many people starved to death.
30 million.
Yes.
And this is the guy from the U.S.-China Friendship Association, the chairman of the U.S. Friendship Association.
How did you get a number? He said, we sent our best demographer in the U.S. to China's Gansu, Ningxia province.
Which I've been to both places, yeah.
Yeah, in 1980s, early 1980s. And he asked the local official, how many people starved to death during Great Forward? Right? And yeah. They told us how many people starved to death. Well, so that's how you figure out how many people starved 20 years after the event. Right? Did your demographer ask the local officials, were they there at the time? Right?
Yeah.
How could you ask the local official 20 years after? These people were not there at the time, maybe. Right?
But you were.
I work. I said, let me tell you how I figure out. How did I figure out how many people starved to death? I went to the places where the famine is supposed to be the worst. I went to every household. I called the village older people first together and asked them how many people starved to death in this village. Some people said 100. Some people said 200. Some said 50. Any numbers. I said, okay, tell me the people's name who starved and how old were they, right?
And these were people that were old enough to have remembered and been there, yeah.
Right? Yeah. All who were 60 years old people who all lived through. In the end, the biggest number people give to me is 15 people in a village of 2,000.
Yeah, instead of 200 or 300.
Yes, all these people were over 60 years old. They were not starved. They just died during the 3 years. Everybody who died during that 3 years was considered starved to death.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like Western propaganda to me.
It was.
It sounds like, because of just the hatred, Western hatred of communism and
yes.
Socialism, et cetera.
Yeah.
Well, listen, let's move on to the other great boogie bear in Western iconography as far as China is concerned, and that's the great proletarian Cultural Revolution. And, of course, that's the title of your book, The Unknown Cultural Revolution. At that time, you were 10, 11 years old, so you must have many memories of the Cultural Revolution. So just like you did with the Great Leap Forward, just please tell us what your experiences were, what happened to you and what happened to the country?
You know, the Cultural Revolution was a very, very exciting time for ordinary Chinese people, because it was for the first time in human history the ordinary people was able to argue, debate, question the officials on an equal basis. For the first time, we never had that kind of experience before. I was 11 years old. I was at third grade. Many people in the outside China or in some parts of China argued the school was closed during the Cultural Revolution years. But the truth of the matter is, my school never closed. My school was on, was in session all the time. We, as youngsters, went out at night to be part of the revolution. We watched how the grown-ups debate with officials about important issues of the country and about the working style of the officials. I still remember some of the Red Guards asked the county magistrate why he was so fat. I mean, that kind of question, right? I mean, it's very, very interesting to me. Why you were so fat? Why other people are not as fat as you were, right? I mean, that's a ridiculous question.
Yeah, because he was eating so well.
Yeah, according to Chairman Mao's writing, right? The officials should be serving the people, should work with the people, right? But apparently, yeah, the officials, after greedy forward, eat better, ate better than the ordinary people. They didn't work harder as the common people. That's why they were fatter than others. I mean, the people asked that kind of questions and put them on the stage, forced them to apologize to the people. That's very, very powerful. Right? I think that's
exactly.
Very, very... Yeah, a lot of people said the Cultural Revolution was oppressive. God, when the common people can write big character posters criticizing their leaders, how could they be feel oppressive? Oppressed?
Well, unless you were the corrupt leader.
That's right. Right? I remember in my school, and the teacher always maintain a very, very high-handed and style in the classroom. We were not allowed to speak. We had to sit with our hands behind our backs, right?
Yeah.
And the teachers were very, very high-handed in the classroom. And I brought to school a playing card. My uncle bought it as a gift for me. And I brought it to school the first day, and he took it. And the card, I didn't play with the card. My card just fell out of my book bag, and he confiscated it and never returned to me.
Oh, no.
Right? And my family, my grandfather went to Europe during World War I, and he brought back from France a souvenir, a very, very beautiful carved knife. And my father treasured that knife very much. I stole it. I took it to school without my father's permission.
Oh, you took it to school without your father's permission?
Yeah. My teacher confiscated it. I never returned to me.
Oh, my gosh.
I was not able to tell my father where the card, where the knife went. So I never was able to get it back. But during the Cultural Revolution years, I mean, the first big character poster I wrote was, where is my card? Now, where is my knife? Right? Confronting my teacher.
Yeah.
I didn't get the money back, but I was able to write that on a wall and put on the big character posters. I felt so empowering for me as a student in the third grade to speak up against my teacher.
Who stole from you?
Yeah, I was empowered by that. I would argue my teacher became a better teacher because the students speak up. My teacher later on became very, very different teacher because of the criticism he got from the students.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with us after the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. We set up a factory in the school with her help. We set up a farm with her help. We did a lot with her involvement in the Cultural Revolution activities.
And this is one of the greatest mysteries. I have heard everything from, now you give in your article, the trilogy article, which I will post, you know, thousands of schools were opened, and just in your area alone. And so one of the biggest mysteries for me when I read your article is you said that before the Cultural Revolution in 1966, that even in spite of the Communist Revolution in 1949, education had not changed that much from 49 to 66. Is that true?
So why were it true? Because okay. The elites were still controlling the field of education.
So the elites were still controlling the education
system.
They
always talk about standard education, quality, they always talk about quality. And they didn't allow the more government spending in the rural schools. You know, my village never had a real school. I mean, my village and the other two villages shared one school, was a temple, former temple. It's called Double Temple School. And they have one class for the first grade, and one class for second grade, one class for third grade, and one class for fourth grade. In order to promote to the fifth grade, you need to take exam.
Yeah, take a test, yeah.
Yeah, in order to qualify for the fifth grade. And most people in my village were not able to pass that test. Why? Because they didn't want you to go. Because the school, in order to go to fifth grade, you need to leave the village, cross the river to another very far place to be in the fifth grade.
Oh, I see. To go to to another village to go to fifth grade, because you didn't have a fifth grade.
Yeah. Another thing is, in order to go to first grade, you need to pass a test as well.
Oh, just to go to first grade, you had to pass a test.
You have to be able to count to 100. You have to be able to write some Chinese characters. For people like me, my parents, they are illiterate. Right? Yeah. I never get that kind of training to go to first grade. And then most of my cousins were not able to go to school, who are older than I was. And my sister was only able to finish two grade, then drop out, because school was too tough for them. But so, during the couple of years,
you said thousands of schools were opened by the villagers and
county,
common people.
Yeah, in my village, in my county, we had 1,050 villages during the couple of years. Every village built one primary school for their own village. Every kid in the village were able to attend primary school free of charge. It's become a norm for every farmer's child to go to primary school. That's one development. The other development was more important. In my county of 750,000 people at the time, there were only seven middle schools.
Seven middle schools for 750,000 people.
Yes. It's so hard to go to a middle school. A middle school.
Yeah.
I remember in one year in 1959, there were only one young man in the whole village was able to go to middle school. And he dropped out after one semester. Why? The school was very, very far away. And he had to brought food to the school in order to be able to eat. And he was not able to afford the tuition and other things. So he dropped out after the semester. He was the only person able to go to pass exam to go to middle school. Okay? During the conference years, we set up 249 middle school in the county. Every four villages shared one joint middle school. Every kid was able to go to middle school without a screening test. Everybody was automatically qualified to go to middle school.
And how much did it cost?
It cost the government. I don't think government spent much money on it. It's built by farmers.
But I mean, did the kids have to pay to go?
No, it was free.
Oh, it was free education.
Middle school was free. There were four classes in my middle school. Each class had 80 kids. It's four villages shared one middle school. So everybody will be able to go, right?
Well, let me ask you this then, Dongping, because, literacy levels in 1949 were
10%.
Were about, 20%. The numbers
are
10-20%. It depends on, who you ask.
That's only 10%.
But by the 19, today it's 99%. And so are you saying that the literacy levels from 1949 until the Cultural Revolution did not increase that much, or they only increased in the cities? I mean, how did the Chinese get the literacy level up so high?
It increased very little.
Okay, until 1966.
Very little. Because most people, like my people who are older than I was, a few years, my cousins were not able to go to school.
Okay. So what you're saying is that because of the Cultural Revolution and because the people were able to reject or throw out the elite
yes.
education.
That's what happened.
The elite education system. Yeah. That was when literacy really took off.
I have a theory. If you allow educators to make educational policies, it always turned out the educators benefit from the system more than the students and the people.
I think what this elite education system goes back to is it had its merits. I mean, the old Mandarin system, the old Mandarin testing system, the eight-legged test, where anybody who devoted the time and the energy to learning Chinese and could pass the Mandarin exam could enter, even a poor kid, could, enter into the Mandarin, administration and so there was some equality to it, but
it's better compared with the Western inheritory system.
Yeah,
no doubt about that. But the system has its own defects.
It had its own defects because it was just enough people to run the government. But what you all wanted to do, what you all wanted to do was to educate everybody.
That's right.
Yeah. So. What do you think? I mean, there was obviously in the Cultural Revolution, the Red Guards, as you said, it was very liberating. They were able to. There's a great quote by Mao Zedong that when he before the start of the Cultural Revolution, he said, you could buy a village leader for two packs of cigarettes, that it was very, very, that they had gotten very corrupt and very fat, as you said, very fat and lazy, and were not at the same level as the masses, the common, the laborers and the peasants. And he said you could buy, a cadre for two packs of cigarettes and something also about you could even marry his daughter or something for a pack of cigarettes or something like that. So there was obviously a lot of corruption at the village and local level that Mao wanted to overturn, and obviously he felt like from 1949 to 1966 that it was not going to happen coming from the top down, and that it had to happen from the bottom up. Now there are there go ahead.
I didn't finish just now about high school.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Before
Forgive
the
me.
Cultural Revolution, there were only one high school in my county.
For 750,000 people.
Yes, and they
Gosh.
trained all together, and 1,500 graduates. Of these 1,500 graduates, more than half went to college, never come back to the village. The rest of the 700 went to join the army or went to work for the government. The countryside never had any educated talents. There were not even one high school in most villages in my county before the Cultural Revolution. During the Cultural years, the people in Jima County set up 89 high schools.
From 1 to 89.
Yes. Every commune has, on average, about three high schools. When I went to high school, 70% of my high school graduates were able to go to high school without a test and free. By the time my younger sister graduated from middle school, the next year, 100% were able to go. Right?
Wow.
There were no one high school graduate in my village. By the time I graduated from high school, there were more than 15,000 high school graduates in my commune. There were almost 100 people graduate from high school with me the same year in the same village. So the change, as far as the literacy is concerned, it's unbelievable.
So what you're saying, Dong Ping, is that if without the Cultural Revolution, you probably would not be a PhD professor
Of course, there's no way.
at Warren Wilson College in Asheville,
Yeah,
North
there's no way.
Carolina.
Yeah.
No way.
I'm not talking about it myself. I'm talking about how the Chinese people, in general, benefit from the Cultural Revolution educational reform. It's a revolution.
Yeah.
For the first time, every farmer's child were able to go to school and get educated. High school graduation education is no longer something cannot, right? It's possible for the farmer's children.
What about the I know that in the summer of 1968, the Mao created the Red Guards, and it would appear that some of them got out of hand, and there was a lot of vandalism and destruction of cultural sites and stuff. Do you feel like that really happened? Do you feel like, I mean, people were, tortured and some were murdered and killed and stuff. Do you feel like that happened? And is that something that was excessive
Let me
and
tell you
regrettable?
something.
I'm
Yeah.
sorry.
The Red Guard was created not in 1968. It was created in 1966.
Okay.
Okay? The Red Guard label is very, very broad. There are different groups of Red Guard. At the beginning of the Constitution, when 1966 in May, and after, every high school, every middle school in China created Red Guard by the school administration. Okay? These people were very, very wild for a while. They targeted some of the teachers with the help of their administration. school administration. Some of the teachers with bad social background. And that's how the school administration mobilized the students, the official Red Guard, to attack these people. Right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these people were already working for the socialist cause. They were not the problem or the target of Mao's Cultural Revolution. But the Chinese official class wanted to divert the real target of the Cultural Revolution to these people. So many of these people were attacked, and some of them cannot handle the attack. Some of them committed suicide. Mm-hmm. I will tell you, the number is not very big. I mean, in America, every day, more than 125 people died because overdose. Right?
Oh, of drugs, yeah.
Drug overdose. Is it compared with the United States, how many people are killed compared with what during the Cultural Revolution years? It's nothing. There's one very important figure. Professor Kong Jun-dong of Beijing University. He talked with some of the Chinese public security officials. He said during the Cultural years, the crime rate in China was only 100,000 for a whole country. 100,000.
Oh, 100 criminal acts were committed during in the entire country. Okay.
Each year.
Yeah.
It's nothing. How many are there in the U.S. on every year now? Right?
Yeah.
We have much bigger population. I don't think the crime or the violence during country years is a reason for anybody to talk about. I mean, there are more people committing suicide, more crime, more violence committed today in China than during the Cultural Revolution years.
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine, explained it as that the Cultural Revolution, and he actually traveled here, Godfrey Roberts, he actually traveled here, I think, in 1967, and spent time here in Shanghai, and as he explained it to me is that the Cultural Revolution, you know, the common people loved it, and the elites hated it because
yes.
They were the ones that Mao wanted to bring down a notch or two,
yeah,
and as you explained in your article that I read, because of the Cultural Revolution, the managers of businesses and farms, et cetera, had to work X number, 250 days or 300 days a year with the workers.
Yeah.
At the level of the workers, they couldn't sit in their offices and eat and drink all day. They got paid the same amount of money as the common people.
Yeah,
they worked just as hard. They lived in the same houses. They wore the same clothes. They were not above the workers. And as I understand it, I think my takeaway is that the Cultural Revolution gave the Chinese a voice, and that they now don't. There are hundreds of protests every day here in China, which sounds like a lot, but it's not really because it's a huge country.
Yeah.
And most of these protests are legitimate, land grabs and corrupt officials and trying to build a chemical plant in my backyard and trying to, build something that shouldn't be built, et cetera. And without the Cultural Revolution, after 5,000 years of, being a mostly feudal society, even in the best of times, with a great emperor and a well managed kingdom, it was still, the peasants were still expected to shut up and keep their mouths shut and just and not express themselves and accept their lot, and the Cultural Revolution really gave the Chinese the idea that they have the right to stand up and speak up and exercise their democratic rights, and complain when people above them are taking advantage of them.
Yes.
And so without that, without the Cultural Revolution, those 300 to 500 protests a day here in China would not be happening, because for 5,000 years they would never have done it, and now they know they can, and they do, and it makes the it makes society better, and it exposes corrupt officials, it exposes corrupt business practices, it exposes pollution, it exposes bribery and everything else. So I think again, just there's so many books that are just against the Cultural Revolution, and obviously some people did suffer, some people did die, some people were killed, there were some suicides, it was an intense 10 years. But I think in retrospect, in spite of those negatives, it was so overwhelmingly positive for the people, especially the educational aspect, which I didn't know until I read your article.
I would argue the Cultural Revolution completely transformed Chinese society.
Yeah.
The Chinese people are no longer the same people anymore after the Cultural Revolution. And people are more inclined to speak up, more inclined to defend their rights. And the Chinese officials hate the Cultural Revolution, I think mostly for that reason.
Because they were now accountable.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, and then there was the wonderful part where Mao Zedong sent the educated elite to the countryside in 68 to get an education from the masses, and Xi Jinping, the president of China, said it was one of the best things that ever happened to him, and he does not regret it, and that it changed him and made him and it turned him from a boy into a man.
I think that's an honest assessment. And I'm very, very grateful to the Cultural Revolution, because it's the Cultural Revolution made what I am.
Yeah.
And I'm prepared to fight for my own rights, for other people's rights as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, again, here you are, and also Mo Bo Gao wrote about this, and Hao Qi in this trilogy, and I really hope I have a chance to talk to them too, because you all each bring a very unique perspective. But all three of you were saying, and also the economic statistics in the Cultural Revolution, it's just unbelievable. It was the economic activity, the agricultural production, even with all the revolutionary ferment, the economy still grew over 6% a year on average during the Cultural Revolution.
We actually feel our lives are filled with hope. Life become better each year. And we really, really feel our future is bright at the time. And we didn't have much pollution. And the water, the river was clean. And there, we don't have much. And pollution at the time. Why? Because we don't have private ownership. Mm-hmm. We own things together. We will not allow any individual to destroy our environment, because it's our environment. Mm-hmm. But now, because of privatization, and the people were allowed to do whatever with what they own. I mean, the Chinese pollution today is unbelievable. You know that. You live in China.
Yeah, I live in China, yeah.
Yeah, the common people suffer so much. They lost control of their own lives.
Well, I tell you what, I really am going to, I can't wait to get your book, which is probably in an envelope from flying on a slow boat to China, the unknown cultural revolution. And I will definitely post your link in this article. You do talk about the fact that the third part of this interview that I want to talk about is after Mao died, and obviously, you know, you and Mo Bogao and Hao Qi and this trilogy are very disillusioned about the fact that the revolution did not continue after Mao died, and that the Deng Xiaoping took the country in a completely different direction. And you're obviously not a great fan of Deng Xiaoping. Just tell us, you know, why you feel like China made a mistake by not continuing, say, like a Cuba or, you know, an Eritrea or another communist country who continued with the communist revolution. And explain to our listeners out there why you feel like that, in spite of all the success that China has had economically and on the world stage, why it would have been better to have stuck with the revolution and to have tried to make it better.
Okay. Right after Mao died, and then right after I went to college in 1978. In the spring of 1978, and for some reason, I was the only one that year in my whole commune of the more than 12,000 high school graduates. 2,000 people took the exam, right? I was the only person succeeded in the exam to go to college. So I left the village when the Chinese government decided to divide up the land. And when I came back that summer, I had a survey among the farmers about how they feel about the dividing up the land. I remember the return with the survey. About 95% people said the Communist Party discarded us. They don't care about us anymore. That's the overwhelming attitude toward dividing up of the community, the commune property, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I was not very, very sure about this. Actually, I just want to keep that as a record. So I did that survey. That I interviewed some people. I did a survey. And then when I returned to back to school, I got my degree. I was sent to teach in Henan province. I have a lot of students from the countryside. I talked to them. I went to their village to interview some of the farmers. I found out it's very, very universal. Many, many farmers in Henan, and later I went to Anhui as well, all the people opposed to divide up the collective. Why? Because the farmers knew they need to have a community in order to succeed. And when they have a new community, it would be very hard for them to be successful together. And that's exactly what happened in Chinese countryside. Right? Some people get very rich very, very quickly. Some people went down. And a lot of land was being abandoned. And a lot of people were not able to afford to send their children to school anymore.
Yeah, you know, I wrote now they had to start paying.
Yes, that's why I started my dissertation. In 1985, I was in the countryside with a group of American professors. Wherever we go, there were a lot of big crowd of children, people following us, right?
Yeah.
I dragged a few child from the crowd. And I asked them to read a headline of newspaper. They all shook their heads. I thought they were shy, but other people told me they were not in school. In 1985, they were not in school. I said, how could that be possible? Then it's very easy to figure out, because the public school where used to be free were no longer there.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers had to pay to send their children to school, and they couldn't afford. They were on their own. And later on, because I found out, farmers were no longer able to afford medical care. And the things people take for granted in the past, in the cultural years, were now gone. Right? The Chinese media always see the farmers welcome Deng Xiaoping's reform and welcome these reform matters. But the truth of the matter, you cannot find a farmer in the countryside. Right? Deng Xiaoping's reform was good. You know, Anhui province is very interesting. That's where the supposedly the dividing up, right? The household responsibility system.
Oh, yeah, the household responsibility system.
Yeah, started there. I went to Anhui in 1998 to attend a conference. I met this professor from Anhui University. He was the chairman of the Department of Sociology. He, like myself, growing up in the countryside, went to college in 1978. But he came to the United States like me too. He attended University of Georgia. But unlike me, he returned to China to teach. I stayed in the U.S. We both did research in the countryside for more than 10 years. So I asked him at the time, I said, Professor Wang, you have a very similar life experience like myself, and you did research in the countryside in the southern China. I did in northern China. I want to ask you a very simple question. How does Chinese farmer in southern China, right, assess Mao and Deng's legacy? Very neutral question. He told me in front of many scholars and many provincial government leaders. He said, in my 10 years doing research in Anhui province, I never meet one farmer who said Deng Xiaoping was good. I never met one real farmer who said Mao was bad. You know, many people think farmers were uneducated, were stupid. I want to tell you, the farmers are the most smart people. They knew who mean well for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, the other question was, on the one side, doesn't surprise me, because the same. It's my discovery in China, in Shandong province. But I asked him, but then how do you explain Xiaogang village, the farmer Xiaogang village decision to break up the collectives? And he said, you know, Xiaogang village is the biggest secret of the People's Republic. I said, what do you mean? He said the whole thing was a fake.
Oh, you mean you're talking about when they broke up the collective farms and did the household responsibility, and that was
it was
a model for the world, for the country? Okay.
Yeah, the whole thing was a fake. And he said, he challenged me. Said, if you don't believe me, you try go to Xiaogang village. See whether you were able to you'll be allowed to go there to see. Right?
Yeah.
And I picked his challenge, and I was not able to go.
They wouldn't let you go?
Yes. I was stopped. We were stopped by the police. Right? Number one. But later I figured out, because I was a farmer myself. I said, if I were a farmer in the countryside, and I want to break up the collective, something as illegal at the time, right? Would you I write agreement with other conspirators to leave a record we decide to break up the collective? Right?
Yeah.
Would you do that? If you were a farmer, you are going to do something illegal. Do you want to leave a trail of record? You don't. Right?
Yeah.
Supposedly you are wanting to see the people to be bound by this agreement. if you were put in jail, you will, the other rest will help the family, right? That's supposedly they do that, write that agreement. If your conspirators didn't want to keep their promise, what can you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, what
with
do you
agreement, with writing?
Yeah.
Who do you expect the government will enforce the agreement for you? Because yeah. You need, right?
Yeah.
Only a scholar, only somebody's working in the office will think out some stupid idea like that. Farmers will now do something that stupid.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about, I think it was in 1978 that Deng Xiaoping at the United Nations General Assembly, one of the lines in his speech then was, is that China must develop, China must modernize, because if China does not develop and modernize, that China will be bullied on the world stage. Do you feel like that was a valid point to incorporate capitalist methods and to adopt capitalist tools to make the country richer? Do you think that was worth it in retrospect?
No, I think this whole modernization theory is a misguided. Why? China was bullied by the Western imperialism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not because China was not modernized. It's because the Chinese ruling class, right, didn't want to fight. They don't care if Chinese people had to pay a high price. Because they were able to defend themselves. They were continuing to enjoy their lives, the ruling class. So they didn't care. China was very poor in 1950. But China was able to fight back.
Oh, yeah, in the Korean Western War. And beat the United States in Korea, yeah.
Yes. And the Chinese people were able to beat the United States in Vietnam, too.
Yeah, yeah.
It had nothing to do with modernization. The problem is the Chinese people need to unite. When the Chinese people united, I don't think anybody dare to bully Chinese people.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue today China, of course China today is a very different story, but still, the Chinese society today is more vulnerable than during the Cultural Years. Why? At that time, because workers, because farmers, they really, really agree with the Chinese national leaders. The Chinese people united like one man. Nobody dared to challenge China at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Today, China did have more hardware, but the Chinese society was no longer as united as mm-hmm. during the Cultural Years.
Mm-hmm.
The gap between the rich and poor are tearing the Chinese society apart.
Well, let's hope that I think that the current president Xi Jinping, you know, senses some of this, and maybe his yes. 7 years in Shanxi province, you know, where he's trying. I think he's trying to bring back the idealism and the hard work of the Cultural Revolution and.
Yes.
And he's trying. I think he wants to reject Western consumerism and bring China back to a more you know socialist / communist way of life. With it, but you know, obviously,
China can be saved. The only way humanity will be able to save itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We need to get everybody on board. We need to get everybody to think, right, about our future together, common future together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this has been an amazing interview, Dong Ping, and I'm just so honored and privileged to have a chance to listen to you and talk to you And I'm very, very excited to share this interview with people all over the world. And I can't wait to read your book. And I hope we stay in touch. I hope I can also have a chance to interview Mo Bogao and Hao Qi, who contributed to this trilogy. And I know Mobo has written a couple of books.
Yes.
About Mao. I don't think Hao Qi's written a book, but he's done a lot of research on labor and workers, you know, pre 1978 and post 1978. And I think, you know, I know I'm going to get an education reading your book, and I know I'm going to get an education reading Mobo's books, and I hope I can, you know, get a hold of some of the reports from Hao Qi. So this has just been a terrific opportunity for me personally. I guarantee you, I've written a book called China Rising, and it just came out earlier this year. Mm. And I wish I could.
It's published by American Press.
Yeah, it's available. It's available on Amazon.
Okay.
And
I'll ask the library to order one.
Okay. Well, thank. Well, right now it's just an ebook. But if they have if they do ebooks, your library should have ebooks.
Yes.
They could order the ebook.
Yes. Yes.
But they are gonna do a print version here. But I have another. It's out by Punto Press. It's called China Rising, Capitalist Roads, Socialist Destinations. And
that's very good title.
Yeah. And so, and then I have another book coming out with another publisher called China is Communist, Damn It. And where I try to explain to Westerners, you know, where I think China was communist way before Karl Marx. You know, I think it's pretty common. The communist philosophy has been part of Chinese culture going back, you know, 5,000 years.
That's a very good point.
And
you are very, very good on that. I always tell my students about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't know.
Well, they can buy my book when it comes out.
Yeah.
Later this year, hopefully. Yeah. And anyway, I'm going to go back. I just sent it to my editor for the second corrections. But based on everything that you told me, and everything I read in your all's trilogy, I'm going to go back and actually make some changes before it goes to press, because I really feel like even my interpretation of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution is not as accurate as it could be and should be. And I wish I could go back now and even change China Rising, but it's kind of late now.
Yeah.
And but anyway, this has been a tremendous education for me, and I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule. And I know you're a busy professor and have lots of students to take care of and educate. And being a fellow teacher, I know how busy that can be.
You are welcome. Thank you.
And thank you so much, Dongping. And let's stay in touch.
Yes.
After I read your book, maybe we can have a follow up interview. And by that time, I'll have interviewed Mo Bogao and Hao Qi, and we'll have quite a library of wonderful interviews to share with people all over the world.
Okay.
Hey, thank you so much, Dongping, and
you are welcome, Jeff.
Congratulations on President Trump being the new president. I think that it offers some hope that, as he said in his acceptance speech, we are looking for reconciliation with everybody around the world, and we are not looking for confrontation.
That's very good.
And that's
very good part.
And that's exactly what the United States and China need.
Yes.
If Clinton had been elected, I'm afraid we would have had World War III. So
yeah, the speech would be very different.
Yeah, I think there's some hope that China and the United States can start working together instead of the United States trying to destroy China's way of life.
Yes, I know. Agree.
Well, listen, Dong Ping, have a great day, and I'll let you know as soon as this interview's up and on China Rising Radio Sinoland.
Okay, thank you.
This is Jeff J. Brown, who had just talked to Dr. Dong Ping Han in the United States. I am the author and journalist on China Rising Radio Sinoland at www.chinarising.puntopress.com. Thank you, everybody, and have a good day. Bye-bye.